This week's episode is sponsored by Amico & Co, the full-service refit shipyard at the heart of the Med, with large yacht facilities, in-house departments, and berthing in its waterfront marina. To find out more, visit amicoshipyard.com. Hello and welcome to this week's episode of Boat Briefing. My name is Katia Damborski. I am the Superyachts Editor at Boat International, and today we're going to be looking back at one of the discussions from the Explorer Yacht Summit, which took place in mid-November at the Yacht Club de Monaco. Now, I'm a little biased when I say that this is one of my favourite panels of the day because I organised this particular discussion, and it was with the captain of the 73-metre Admiral Motor Yacht Planet 9, Philip Atkinson. Now, when I first heard this story, I thought it was such an incredible tale of a really high-stakes rescue in the mid-Atlantic, and it had so many twists and turns, and I was worried that we weren't going to be able to condense it down into a short discussion on stage, but I think we managed it, and I'm really excited to share it with you today. I hope you enjoy.
So, the sailing yacht, they were roughly 600 nautical miles west of Cape Verde when they crash-jibed in the early hours of the morning. So the boom swung across just so violently, with so much force, it ripped a fitting out of the deck and just launched it like a missile, blowing a hole through one of the crew members' ankles, who just happened to be standing in the wrong place at the wrong time. So this caused a compound fracture and dislocation. It wasn't just pretty banged up. It was really quite serious. You could see the bone and there was a lot of blood. In the same time, the boom also struck another crew member in the head and they were left unconscious and also bleeding on the deck. So this must have been a really frightening moment for the rest of the crew, because it was pitch black, 3 to 4 meter seas, a good 30 knots of wind or more. And not only did they now have to try and recover control of a damaged vessel, but they also had to treat two really serious, potentially life-threatening injuries. So there were 9 people on board, including the owner's 2 teenage kids. And interestingly, like all the emergency equipment on the bridge, I was actually first notified by the MRCC via WhatsApp. We were only 40 miles away and the closest boat that could offer the best assistance.
Okay, so you're 40 miles away and this was in the middle of the night, right? So what did we decide was the best course of action?
Well, the initial request from the MRCC sounded really simple. Catch up with the sailing yacht, transfer these two patients and then get them to shore as quickly as possible. So in all likelihood, that was going to mean turning around and punching back through this 3 meter swell, the 600 miles to Cape Verde. However, once we caught up to the sailing yacht, due to the weather conditions, it was just immediately obvious that there was no chance of a patient transfer. And adding to the difficulty, damage in the mast and the rigging meant that they couldn't drop their main sail. So yeah, they couldn't do anything. They couldn't stop. They couldn't turn around. They just had to plow ahead at the mercy of the wind. So looking at the forecast, we decided the next best option was to travel 800 nautical miles northwest. So both boats heading off together, where we hoped there'd be a little window that would allow them to drop the sail and to make the transfer. So this passage really highlighted the sea capabilities of expedition yachts and one of the reasons why Planet 9 was so well suited. So we had a good 3 meter sea just aft of the beam, consistent 20-25 knots of wind, and yes, certainly other motor yachts I've worked on would really have struggled. And what made it even harder was the sailing yacht could only do 5 or 6 knots at night. They were just limping along. So this really reduced the effect of our stabilizers. But yeah, fortunately, with the expedition yacht design focused on enhanced handling and seaworthiness, Planet 9 was able to ride out those conditions just exceptionally well. And fortunately, we were in Cape Verde to bunker, so we had about 330,000 litres of fuel on board, and this really helped our slow-speed stability.
Okay, so you spent the next 5 days just following along with this sailing yacht in the hope that you'd be able to transfer 2 pretty injured patients on board, right?
Yeah.
So how are you spending those 5 days?
Well, these 5 days were really frustrating for the crew because it felt like we weren't doing anything, weren't able to do anything. So what this led to was lots and lots of brainstormings where, you know, we just looked at anything and everything. And always in my mind was the thought, what else can we be doing? What else should we be doing? So we walked through everything we thought it was going to take to do a successful patient transfer. So, you know, what's the best tender to use? How do I minimize the risk to my crew launching tenders in an ocean swell? And just the basics, how do we get a really injured person from the interior of a smaller sailing yacht into our tender, from the tender onto Planet Nine, and then from there into a comfortable bed? We also ran through all of our man overboard procedures and actually set up some of the equipment like that, and just really focused on which one of these procedures will actually work in these sea conditions. And then finally, we drilled for the patient transfer by strapping crew into the tender, lifting them up, into the stretcher, carrying them around, putting them down, taking it off, and then just practiced doing that all over again.
And did you think about sending any aid over to them, like, for example, medical equipment or fuel, things like that?
Yeah, absolutely. So as I was saying, you know, constantly running through my mind was what else can we do or should we be doing? And one of our brainstorming sessions came up with, well, okay, what if they can drop the sail, but we still can't make the transfer? Can we help that way? So, yeah, we looked at being able to send jerry cans of fuel down to them so that if they could start motoring, they didn't have to worry about conserving fuel. And same with the medical kit. They were a really experienced, well-organized crew. They had a decent medical kit. But again, they've had two really serious injuries at the start of an Atlantic crossing. So is there a way, if we can't board their yacht, can we resupply the medical kit? And again, we're looking at using dry bags and floating that down in a log line or something for them to pick up.
It sounds like a really big part of what you were doing is actually providing peace of mind and saying, you know, we'll be with you till the end. We'll follow you as long as you need to be followed, and we'll constantly be there if you need us.
Yeah, absolutely. And we didn't realize at the time, but possibly the best thing we actually did was to simply be there and say to them that, you know, no matter what, we'll stick with you until the end. So once we made the patient transfer, one of the owners came across to Planet Nine, and I asked them, once the helicopter had left and everything had settled down a bit, what it was like from their point of view. So yeah, she told us that with two key members of their team now out of action, the remaining four experienced sailors were working in pairs doing, say, 4-hour shifts. But because the boat was so hard to control, they were regularly being woken up to help assist through squalls and rougher weather. So, yeah, 2, 3, 4 days of this, and they were getting seriously fatigued, and it was really starting to affect their decision-making abilities. So on top of trying to treat these two really serious injuries, they also had the constant stress of knowing that with the mainsail still up and being so overpowered, they were just one mistake away from a potential knockdown. And just to show you how seriously they were taking this, the two teenagers were sleeping in the main salon in life jackets with grab bags right in easy reach. And if all of that isn't enough, and I mean, it is, they also knew that if someone went overboard, there was nothing they could do. They couldn't stop, they couldn't turn around. So yeah, to know that Planet Nine was always there, always following, just brought tremendous peace of mind. But equally, for the poor girl that had the busted ankle, she couldn't get off the couch, but she could see Planet Nine by day and our lights by night, and that brought her just immense comfort and hope.
So a very difficult few days then. How do you eventually get the patient transferred over to Planet Nine and, you know, administered some more medical attention?
So fortunately, the weather did play the game, and it was worth our 800-mile trek. So they could drop the sail, and then we used one of our 10-metre guest tenders to do the transfer. Before we did this, though, we were advised to give her extra medication because, well, as you can see, her foot had been strapped to a chopping board on day one to stop it flopping around. But 5 days later, just any little movement caused extreme pain. The sailing yacht then did a series of trial runs to work out the best course and speed so that you know, they could keep a steady keel whilst she was handed over to the tender. And then, yeah, just the consequences of dropping somebody in the water in the middle of the Atlantic who is seriously injured, now heavily sedated, and also strapped to a stretcher, just doesn't bear thinking about. But, you know, of course, we were all thinking about it. So there are several reasons why Planet Nine was so well suited to this rescue and then the ongoing treatment. But having our expedition-style tenders, very seaworthy, large open deck, and then the easy launching from Planet Nine, we've got two sets of stabilizers. So that made it possible in the first place to do the transfer. And then we ended up using the owner's cabin because it was midships on the main deck and an easy route from the tender, but it also, yeah, there's very little movement there. Then the excellent sea handling characteristics of the expedition yacht, the comfort underway meant that for the first time in 5 days, her foot wasn't flopping around and she could actually get some decent rest. And then the final part of it was, you know, we've got a big open commercial heli deck back there. So you couldn't get a better setup really for a helicopter evac. But more than that, though, it then allowed our crew to do what they do best. And they really looked after our new Mid-Atlantic guests and just really tried to make her feel human again. So anything from massaging her leg regularly to help increase the blood flow to the foot. They applied makeup, painted her nails, brushed her hair. Yeah, and just really, you know, it was the warm, caring actions of the crew that helped as much as anything to get her through a really, really tough time.
Yeah, made her feel human again, I imagine.
Yeah.
And so when she was finally evacuated and taken by the medical team, were you quite sad to see her go?
Yeah, we were actually. It was a really strange mix of emotions because for 8 days and now nearly 1,600 nautical miles, she was our sole focus. So, yeah, it was a strange mix of emotions and we'd formed a really quite tight bond over this period. And, yeah, it was harder than I expected to see strangers come and take her away. But that also raised another interesting point, and I guess it surprised us, and this is in no means taking away from the efforts of the rescue guys, but just the different way the patient was treated. Like for us, she was a real person with a name and a story, and we'd become heavily invested emotionally. So every touch, every procedure we planned, did it with the utmost care. But the medevac guys, they can't afford to let emotion interfere with their jobs. Yeah, they fly in, they pump patient X full of morphine so they can't feel anything. They get them out fast so they can be handed over to the professionals as soon as possible. And a lot of the crew found it really quite upsetting just watching the stretcher get bumped down the side gangways or side decks to the helipad. Just the rough way she was hooked up, and then, well, you saw it there, but in real life, it was just the gut-wrenching speed that she left the deck. It was like a death-defying ride in Disneyland or something. So, that really upset some of the crew.
I can imagine. And then what was the aftermath of the incident?
Well, amazingly, after many, many surgeries, she has made an almost complete recovery to the point where she's now back surfing and loving life. And I'm pretty sure anyone who saw her ankle or what was left of it wouldn't have thought that possible.
And was there anything that rescue in particular taught you? Were there any learnings that you took away from it?
A couple of things, yeah. Just one, never underestimate the power of the strength, hope and comfort that you can give to someone simply by being willing to help. You know, to be able to say to someone, it's all right, I'm here for you, can make all the difference. And of course, if I'm ever in trouble at sea, I hope there's an expedition yacht not too far away.
And this is obviously a pretty incredible rescue, but I understand this was not even there was another rescue later in the day, right?
Yeah, unbelievable. By this point, I'd been at sea on yachts for nearly 18 years and never had an incident. And now, 12 hours after waving goodbye to the helicopter, we were again called by the same MRCC, although by VHF this time, asking if we could assist with a sinking catamaran. So we did. Yeah, and well, it's an absolutely foul night. I was at 1 a.m. in the morning, blowing a gale, pelting down rain. But it really felt like another day, another rescue. And I was blown away by the crew, how they responded. So no one was upset about getting woken up. No one complained about sitting in the rain looking for distress flares. They just went about setting up the boat for another rescue as if they were doing the morning routine set up on a guest trip. So fortunately, we didn't have to do anything this time other than stand by and watch the rescue helicopter winch the two crew to safety. But then as I signed off with them for the night, I said, well, given the last couple of days, no doubt I'll be talking to you tomorrow and we'll be ready for whatever rescue you have for us.
So obviously Planet Nine is a pretty intrepid explorer. Can you tell us some of your most memorable experiences at sea?
Yeah, well, it's been interesting listening this morning and the conflict or do you go north or south? But for me, Antarctica, hands down. Although having said that, if anyone is planning a trip to Australia, I would love to take a boat in the Sydney Harbour and see if that's any more memorable. But yeah, crossing the Drake Passage was amazing. And I think for any yachty seafarer, a great one to tick off. But for me, the highlight is just you're dodging whales and ice and you're just bathed in this most amazing golden light reflecting off the icy mountains of Antarctica in the darkest time of night. So yeah, that was amazing. And never before or since have I enjoyed my alarm clock screeching at me to get up for the 4 o'clock watch. But in Antarctica, there's always something special and a pleasure.
And so we've heard a lot about Antarctica today. Can you tell me something that maybe surprised you about cruising down there?
Yeah, it was touched on a little bit, but just the number of boats that are down there really surprised me. So, well, I just joined Planet Nine about a month before we went, so I didn't really look into it much. But I had this image in my head that you'd feel like you were the only boat on the planet. But this is quickly shattered as you go past another expedition cruise ship and another yacht. But IATO, which is an association of tourist organisations for Antarctica, they work exceptionally hard to reduce the human impact down there, but to also, one of their goals is to enhance the individual experience. And they do this by controlling anchorages. So whilst you have to book your slots way in advance for a few hours, you can really enjoy the deep isolation of Antarctica and pretend that you really are the only yacht on the planet.
But you do have to book in advance. You can't just kind of cruise around.
Yes, you have to book well in advance. And the downside to this is everything becomes so time critical, which is not so great with yacht guests. So if they're not ready, they might only get one chance to step ashore and they can miss out. And it also means you may end up just going around and around in circles all night because you've had to leave one anchorage. And even though the next one's only 20 nautical miles away, you have to wait for your slot.
Can you give us some advice on yachts maybe considering cruising down that way in Antarctica?
It's fuel. Fuel is a big one for me. I thought you bunker in Ushuaia, you get the right fuel and away you go. But there was another yacht that bunkered whilst we were there. And as they headed south into the colder waters, they had issues with their fuel starting to solidify and whatnot. The only option for them turned out they had to turn around and just steam at full speed for 3 or 4 days to burn off the fuel load. And then they went and bunkered with the correct spec fuel. So that was lesson learned. Probably my number one tip, add anchor chain. We've got about 300 meters on port side, and that's brilliant for the deep anchorages. And really offers the captains some peace of mind. Dynamic positioning. If you're into building a boat, don't leave home without that. That's awesome. They touched on it earlier as well, but the ice course for navigators, that's essential. Provisioning also. Again, I thought this was going to be impossible in Antarctica, but we had provisions fly into King George Island, and it was pretty much like the same as any other provisioning run, except we didn't need to worry about the ice cream melting or the prawns going off in the sun. So that was nice. And guests also flew into King George Island, although I imagine a lot of the Explorer yacht owners would rather do the passage and tick that one off. Difficulties, just a lot of our guides and the tour operators were so used to dealing with expedition like cruise ships and stuff. So you tell someone where to go, when to go, and what to do, and they do it. And that's not always the case with yacht guests. So, yeah, there was a bit of difficulties there on trying to replan activities or get guests motivated to go when they had to go.
Are you saying yacht guests aren't very obedient? Is that what you're saying?
No, I wouldn't say that. Just saying cruise ship guests are probably more obedient.
And I heard you went down to Chile as well.
Yeah, so Chile was fantastic, especially after the strict rules and regulations of Antarctica. And it really felt like a bit of a step back in time there. And in so many places, yachts traveling, ships traveling 100 years ago would have seen exactly the same things we did. So, yeah, there were no farms, there were no houses, there were no streetlights, but that's probably because there were no streets. There weren't many other yachts, almost no other yachts. And from what I remember, there was very little rubbish or anything as well. So that was great. But Chile has a lot to offer for the adventurous guests, anything from cruising up relatively uncharted rivers and bays to fishing and hiking and on Planet Nine, perfect place for heli skiing. But the weather can change in an instant, so you really have to pay attention. But the best part then is coming back to the boat for a nice hot drink and relaxing in the sauna with the beach club door open. No, there we go. Yeah, just anchored next to glaciers and ice floating past. So it really is a tremendous experience.
And what are the attractions like on shore in such a kind of undeveloped place? Are there things that guests can do in terms of like excursions and cultural activities?
Yeah, I thought Chile had a really good mix of civilization and wilderness. So you can get away from it all. But then the bigger towns like Punta Arenas, Portomont, there's all manner of tourist activities run out of there. So it's quite easy to book anything from horse rides to guided tours through Tierra del Fuego National Park. And then, well, one of my favorites, the local restaurants offer quite a must-do experience, but maybe not for your vegetarians out there, because you're expect to see anything from half a beast to cute little guinea pigs roasting away on a fire pit in the middle of the restaurant.
Did you try a guinea pig?
I did. Just once, but
never again.
Yeah, they are a bit cute.
And what would you say is the main difficulty of traveling in places like Chile, like Antarctica? You touched on it a little bit before, but what would you say are the main challenges?
One of the things, especially through Chile, quickly learned not to trust your ECTIS or your normal navigation systems. Go and get hold of some local charts. And we just tried to limit our navigation to daylight hours as well. But then through Chile, probably our biggest issue were trying to keep the pilots on board, especially through places like Straits of Magellan, where they're normally transiting on commercial yachts and getting paid per transit. So, yeah, every time we stopped and dropped anchor to explore somewhere, they just got a little bit more angrier and angrier until eventually they demanded that we get them off the boat, and we were stuck at anchor for a couple of days waiting for their replacements to come. But yeah, I mean, it's little adventures and scenarios like that that just make traveling remote areas so much more interesting and memorable.
Absolutely. Lots of adventures there.
Lots of adventures.
And what do you see as the future of explorer yachting?
Oh, this is a tough one. It's a tough one, but okay. For me, I think explorer yacht owners and crew have a different mindset, a different attitude. So it's not all about coming here and being seen, but rather what you can see and what you can do. And I think programs and initiatives like Yachts for Science they're a very, very good thing. And explorer yachts are the best equipped for this, both in terms of functionality and destinations traveled. So I think yachting is going to come under increasing scrutiny from the environmental sectors. But if we can use explorer yachts as a tool for scientific study, research, and education, we can showcase yachting in a positive light. And I think this will play an increasing role in the future of explorer yachts. And if it does, it's something I'd like to be a part of.
Brilliant. Well, ending on a very positive note there. Do we have any questions from the audience?
Hello. What was the knock-on effect of you delaying Mid-Atlantic? Was there a commercial impact, or how did that affect your program?
Well, that's a great question. And I'm sure that comes up a lot with any of these rescues. But for us, even right from the start, where it looked like we were going to turn back and have to do 650 miles back, so, you know, an extra 1,300 miles, owners, management just never hesitated. The only question they asked was, what can we do? What else can we do? So I think that, yeah, it's amazing from the owner that his only thought was, how do we help this person? In the end, it didn't delay us, really. It looked like you go all over the place and it would double your miles. But in reality, it only added about 250 miles. And most of our crossings we do at 9 knots or something, 8 or 9 knots. So a lot of this was at tick over. So, you know, 5 days, just one engine, often just ticking ahead. So we didn't burn much more fuel. And then the last 3 days, once we did the transfer, we did speed up as much as possible. But in the end, we were only 24 hours over what we expected to do, which blew me away. That was amazing. And fuel, we didn't burn a whole lot more fuel either. So, I mean, of course, it's fortunate we were going in that direction in the end. But yeah, it didn't add as much as we thought. And we were still good for our Christmas trip.
Anyone else?
Thank you. Fantastic to find out about the rescue operation that you did. Post-rescue and sort of post-debrief with crew, have you changed any of your sort of standard operating procedures, or would you carry different equipment on board? And then would you recommend to other vessels making such a transit to carry specific equipment should that opportunity arise, what you would need to transfer vessel to vessel mid-ocean?
Yeah, if I had my way, the only bit of equipment I'd add is a nurse, medic, someone like that on the crew. We I'm sure I saw someone from MSOS here. So yeah, we run with MSOS, and really from my point of view, the med kits are so extensive. They're not the limiting factor. It's the people that are using them, and it's really hard to get that education. And that's one of the main points I say to my crew on a crossing: look after yourselves, because if you don't, I'm the one that's going to do it, and you don't want that. So, yeah, in terms of equipment, I think it's pretty well stocked. But there was, right at the start, you mentioned there was another yacht available, and the big difference between us and them were the tenders and how we could launch it. So they had to open the boot room door, and in the swell, they were worried about flooding, et cetera. And they also had, even though it was quite a large yacht, the tenders were quite small. So to have the big open decks, big tenders, was a huge thing. And another thing that came up earlier when I was speaking to someone as well, he was saying he was a big advocate for having dedicated hospitals on board or treatment rooms. And that's great. We do have one, but it's on the top deck. So when we went through the logistics of carrying a stretcher up there, you couldn't do it. The stairways are too narrow. It's too steep. So yeah, it's great having the equipment. And if you can design a boat with a hospital on the main deck or something, that's fantastic. But you also need the skills to learn it. And just doing a 5-day course every 5 years, I think that makes it really hard to get the best out of the med kit.
One more question, if anyone has one. Was there anything specifically that you and your crew did post-transfer to kind of decompress from the ordeal that you yourselves had been through?
Yeah, did a guest trip. Very, very relaxing. The crew got a couple of days off in St. Martin, and I didn't want to know what they got up to. And they came back, they had all their fingers and toes, and we just got on with the season.
Well, thank you so much, Philip. I really appreciate that. And thank you, everyone.
Thank you.
Thank you for tuning in to this week's Boat Briefing episode, which is a production of Boat International Media and is mixed and edited by Naomi Wilson. We will see you next week.